From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Siberia, we talk with journalist Frederick Kemp about an expedition that took him through Russia's most remote and desolate region, a place whose very name came to mean punishment. Also, a talk with filmmaker Peter Medak. He made the movies The Ruling Class, The Craze, and Let Him Have It. His own life would make a good movie. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by Edward Wilkerson's band, Eight Bold Souls. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan said today that he expects the economic recovery to pick up speed in the coming months, bringing a gradual improvement in the job market. Greenspan told the Senate Banking Committee that lower inflation will help keep the economic expansion moving, but he warned that the near-term recovery is still likely to be slow. The Fed chief predicted that the unemployment rate will start to ease by the end of the year. Greenspan's forecast indicates that there's not likely to be any dramatic improvement in the economy before the November 3rd election. Bill Clinton's bus caravan continued today from Louisville, Kentucky, into Indiana, Illinois, and Missouri, making campaign stops all the way. NPR's Ira Glass reports.
Yesterday, President Bush attacked Bill Clinton's economic plan as smoke and mirrors, saying it would increase the federal deficit. By noon today, Bill Clinton had repeated his response to that three times. Here he is at a bus stop in Harrison County, Indiana.
If ever there was an expert on smoke and mirrors, it's him.
On this bus trip, Clinton continues to take lots of questions from voters, but not many from reporters, with one event after another designed for TV pictures, on a family farm, at a steel mill, at a small town square, in a school. I'm Ira Glass, traveling with the Clinton campaign.
Later today, the Clinton-Gore bus caravan is scheduled to pull into its final stop, St. Louis, where the candidates will hold a rally tomorrow. Clinton will keep campaigning, though, apparently unwilling to risk the loss of momentum that hit Democratic candidate Michael Dukakis after the convention in 1988. Clinton planned to move on to Houston and the West Coast later in the week after an overnight stop in Little Rock. President Bush visited a Catholic high school in Philadelphia today to promote his school choice plan. The president held a forum with Cardinal Anthony Bevilacqua and a receptive audience of teachers, students, and parents. Tondalea Wilder of member station WHYY reports.
Some 500 students clad in blue and white uniforms joined their teachers and parents in the gymnasium of Archbishop Ryan High School to talk to the president about his school choice plan. The controversial proposal would give parents $1,000 scholarships to send their children to any school they choose. President Bush said school choice will have a hard time getting approved by Congress because it is being fought by the National Education Association.
This NEA crowd is fighting any kind of change because they just like it the way it's been. I don't like it the way it's been, and I want to help those public schools get better, and I want to see families have their choice to send their kids to the schools they want, and that's the message.
Outside, dozens of protesters from a variety of groups blasted the plan, saying the government should not provide public money for church schools. For National Public Radio, I'm Tondalea Wilder in Philadelphia.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 5 points today to close at 3,308. This is NPR News. United Nations weapons inspectors said today that tensions are growing in Baghdad over the UN demands to search Iraq's agriculture ministry. The report came from Richard Hooper, the leader of a 9-member nuclear inspection team that just returned from Iraq to Bahrain. Hooper said that street demonstrations have become almost constant against the UN team that's camped outside the Iraqi Department of Agriculture. Secretary of State James Baker left Israel today for peace talks in Syria, with a stop in Jordan on the way. There, King Hussein told him he welcomed the change of government in Israel and denied that goods and supplies for Saddam Hussein were leaking across Jordan's border to Iraq. Jan Ziff is traveling with Baker in Damascus.
After 2 days of upbeat talks in Jerusalem, Secretary Baker stopped in Amman, hoping to convince King Hussein of Prime Minister Rabin's sincere intent to halt settlement construction. But although the Jordanian leader welcomed the Israeli change of government, he denied Baker's request to provide some sort of reciprocal gesture as a confidence-building measure. Baker told the king he would try to persuade Congress to free up the aid for Jordan that was frozen during the Gulf War because of King Hussein's support for Iraq. In turn, Baker said he'd heard from Jordanian officials of their efforts to curb the leakage across their border with Iraq of goods prohibited by the United Nations sanctions. U.S. officials say they believe Jordan has tried to end the sanctions busting, and they add that what's needed now is constant vigilance. For National Public Radio, I'm Jan Ziff in Damascus, Syria.
Prime Minister Rabin underscored his commitment to Mideast peace talks today by paying a quick visit to Egypt. Rabin met with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak for about 3 hours, and Mubarak agreed to pay a return visit to Israel. Speaking with reporters at a joint news conference after the meeting, Mubarak said that he wished Rabin success, but he was noncommittal about details. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Siberia had been the Soviet Union's most forbidden place. It was a place where Russians had been sent to prison or into exile or to their deaths. My guest Frederick Kemp took a 5-week expedition across western Siberia into areas few, if any, Americans had been allowed to visit in modern times. The expedition he was part of included several other journalists and environmentalists. They traveled along the Ob River, which is about the length of the Mississippi, stretching from the mountains near the Mongolian border to the Arctic Ocean. The expedition ended 3 weeks before the Soviet coup last August. This was Kemp's 12th trip to the Soviet Union. He's been a foreign correspondent for Newsweek and is now the Wall Street Journal's Berlin bureau chief. His new book, Siberian Odyssey, begins with the observation that Siberia has always been more a warning than a place.
Well, it entered my psyche when I was a child. My father is a German immigrant, and he would say to me whenever I misbehaved that I would be sent to Siberia, so it already entered my psyche as some place that was forbidden, a place of punishment. And then over the years, you see different images, Solzhenitsyn, the gulags, you see the oil men cutting through the ice to get to some of the richest deposits in the world, and it all lodges into your memory. There's another side to it as well, and that's political. I've always thought, since I started studying the Soviet Union, that Siberia was a place we didn't look at enough because it has most of the Soviet Union's, former Soviet Union's, raw materials, because it's such a rich place. It really is the place, if Siberia doesn't work, Russia is not going to work. Because Siberia didn't work, the Soviet Union didn't work. Or partly because of that. And so I was also looking at it as the place not only of Russia's nightmares, but also the place of its opportunities.
You write about one of Stalin's mass graves that was unearthed by an act of nature in 1979, and you pass through the town that this grave was unearthed in. What happened in 1979?
Well, it was the spring thaw, and the river is frozen in some places more than 6 months of the year. And during the spring thaw, huge chunks of ice head down the river. And this was on a bend of the river, a very, very high bank. The embankment was about 15, 20 feet high. And these ice chunks hit into the bank of the river, and it's a very sandy bank all the way up the river. And over the years, that kept churning into the river, until it finally reached a mass grave where people that Stalin had assassinated, his enemies, the people were buried. This was a great embarrassment at that time to the regime of Brezhnev. They sent tugboats to the site. Rather than reburying the bodies somewhere else, they just put the tugboats on reverse. They started churning up the water, and the bodies just cascaded into the river. And in the book, I saw this as perhaps a little bit too obvious of a metaphor, but it really was a metaphor that these bodies were coming out of the bank the way truth started coming out. And the system that was built on the lies sort of crumbled like the banks of this river. And it really was chilling to stand there and think of what was there before, and absolutely no monument there. In fact, when I went there, three boys were lying on the beach burying each other in the sand and absolutely oblivious to anything else that had been there. And the only thing there other than these boys was garbage.
Yeah, well, apparently one of the people in the area wants to build a memorial there, but others continue to use it to dump trash.
Well, that's sort of the story of Siberia, as I found it, and I think it's the story of Russia, is that you have individuals. They were called white birds where I went. Individuals who are fighting against the burden of their history, fighting to start up new companies, fighting to reform the educational system. But you have really the bulk of society that's either resigned, a great deal of alcoholism, a society that has been beaten down for so many years that it's really quite ill-prepared to take on the challenges of democracy and the free market, which, of course, requires a great deal of energy. And I walked away from this trip really asking me, can this person who's trying to build the monument on the banks of the Ob, in other words, can people like him, overcome the lethargy and the resignation of society at large?
I think that one of the recurrent themes when you were traveling through Siberia is the sense that there are cities and towns built on bones.
Yeah, it's really, and not only built on bones, but that people are oblivious to it. In Vorkuta, a city in the far north, the last stop of my book. And it was a city created by Stalin because he found coal there. But 100 miles above the Arctic Circle, you're not going to find many people who want to work. And so he sent his prisoners, the political prisoners as well as common criminals. And they populated Vorkuta. The city has hospitals built on top of mass graveyards. It has a sewage treatment plant built on mass graveyards. But people have become just so oblivious to it all, sort of desensitized to it.
How much of the population throughout Siberia is there as a result of the prison camps under Stalin?
There are three types of people in Siberia, or maybe four. The first are the native peoples, and there are 35, 36 different nationalities, ranging from Nenet reindeer nomads to the Khanty people who were more into fishing and hunting. Then there are the people who were sent there in the gulags and their offspring. There are some cities where 30-40% of the population consists of these people. Those are the people who came primarily 30s, 40s, 50s. Thereafter, a new breed of people were sent there, and these were people out to get rich quick. And rich quick means, of course, something a little bit different in the Soviet Union than it means here, but they were getting three or four times the salary that they would get elsewhere in Russia, longer vacations, and so they were going there to get money. And then there was a fourth group, and this is why the Siberians probably have a better chance to take on the new system than others, and these are the independent, free-spirited types of people who would settle in places like Alaska here. They went to Siberia to brave the elements. I was surprised how many Siberians had read Jack London. Jack London was their Bible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frederick Kemp, who is now Berlin bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. His new book, Siberian Odyssey, is based on his trip through Siberia. You went to a Stalin museum in a town where thousands died in Stalinist exile. What was the Stalin museum like?
Well, they're rewriting it now, and they're now turning it into a museum of political exile, remembering that there were also political exiles that had been sent there by Stalin. The most amazing thing was here on this place where the kulaks, these kulaks were the middle-class land-owning farmers that Stalin had to ship off, to a certain extent execute, but mainly send off to other parts to break them so he could collectivize agriculture. They settled here and died by the tens of thousands because of harsh elements and disease. In the same place that they died 20 years or 30 years before, Stalin himself had been in exile. And so the museum that was originally there was not to these people who had died at Stalin's hands, but rather to Stalin. And there was a statue there, of course, to Stalin as well, but that's been taken down. I think the thing that was chilling is in this time of Gorbachev and Glasnost, the curator of this museum was a Stalinist. And she said, look, what are we going to get out of people like Gorbachev and Yeltsin? They don't know how to lead us. What we need is the discipline and the hard work of Stalin. Look where we would have been if he hadn't been around during World War II. And you heard that. I heard that more often than made me comfortable as I traveled through Siberia.
You heard from people who were former Stalinists?
Who were not only former Stalinists,
still Stalinists.
Right. Yeah. And how anyone can be nostalgic for Stalin, knowing what they know about Stalin, boggles the mind. But there is something...
But these were the people who enacted Stalin's wishes, though, aren't they?
Well, to a certain extent, they enacted Stalin's wishes, but these are not the people who like him. It's more the simple people. The simple people are really attracted to the sort of strength that he stands for. The daughter of one of Stalin's secret police chief during the 1930s, and she was the daughter of the man who ordered the executions of the people in the mass grave that we talked about. She said, and I asked her, how can you still like Stalin? How can anyone here still like Stalin? How can you forgive your leaders for what they've done over the years? And she said, you have to say clearly what a Russian is. If a Russian is beaten up for 364 days a year, and for one day a year he's stroked, then he forgives everything else.
So what were the strokes?
Well, I think the strokes are once in a while saying, and people really believe this, once in a while saying, you are better off than the West. Yes, things are hard, but we're building this grand society. You are Russian. You are superior. Now, as long as you didn't have the information era and as long as you didn't have the glasnost under Gorbachev, people believed this. On a train going to Vorkuta, I sat beside some mountain climbers, and they were 20, 23 years old, and they recalled a time when they were in grade school when they collected rubles to send to the poor children of America. And they were very embarrassed when they told me this, and they were wondering if there were some way these rubles could be used in the United States, and they were even more disappointed when I told them that I wasn't quite sure how the rubles could be spent in the United States. But they genuinely believed that they were better off, and that they were the superior system in the world. And I think that's why there's such a depth of disappointment now, is to a certain extent a feeling of betrayal.
Because they're finding out about things that had been kept from them for so many years.
Exactly. I went to the oil fields. In the area I went, Western Siberia, we ran the entire length of the Ob River. It's about the length of the Mississippi, from nearly the border of Mongolia to above the Arctic Circle. About two-thirds into this trip, you hit oil country, where 60% of the country's oil reserves lie. And I talked to two of the oil pioneers. The oil fields were founded in the 1960s. And these were Komsomol members, the Communist Youth League members. They were communist leaders their whole lives. They really believed that part of the reason they were getting low salaries, part of the reason they weren't as well off, perhaps, as an oil man in Texas or anywhere else, was because they were serving the greater whole. And then, near retirement, they discover that not only are they not well off, but their country's not well off. And, of course, there's a sense of betrayal.
Mm-hmm. Part of the reason why there were so many prison camps in Siberia was the amount of natural resources discovered there, like coal. And Stalin needed people to mine the resources, and nobody really wanted to voluntarily move there, so people were forcibly sent there. Now, there's a lot of environmental messes in Siberia now as a result of the industrialization and the mining. What are some of the environmental problems that you saw?
I think one of the most striking things, and what I didn't expect in going to Siberia, was the beauty. It is just breathtaking. And the swamplands, who would think swamplands would be so beautiful? The largest swamplands in the world are in the northwest of Siberia, three times the size of Alaska. Three times the size of Texas. And these swamplands, which are called, they're called God's unfinished work, because the natives say this is where God forgot to separate the land from the water. And you look down on this area from above in a helicopter, and this is another one of the interesting stories. We would rent helicopters for vodka, because vodka was the most popular currency, and usually, you know, 5 to 10 bottles a day would get you a helicopter. From above, from this helicopter, you saw this epic Japanese garden. It was just gorgeous. And then you would pass areas where the oil men had been, or where they still were and oil was leaking, and you see these huge black places. And you'd see also huge brown places the forest, the taiga, the eternal forest there, had burned down. And this had been caused, the people who were showing us around told us, partly because the oil men would leave their vodka bottles in the winter, in the snow, out in these areas. The summer would come, the sun would shine through the vodka bottle, it would act as a magnifying glass on the then dry earth, and you'd have this enormous forest fire, and they've lost a great deal of the region there. We had a Greenpeace ecologist along on our expedition, and he was saying that no one has really focused on these swamplands yet, but he believed that ultimately the damage to the swamplands could harm the environment, the ozone layer, even more than the destruction of the rainforest in Brazil.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Frederick Kemp, and he's the author of the new book Siberian Odyssey about his five-week trip through Siberia. It's his 12th trip to the Soviet Union. He's been a foreign correspondent for Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal. He's now Berlin bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Frederick Kemp is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Siberian Odyssey. Is Siberia still a place where there are a lot of prisons?
There still are a lot of prisons there. Before, it was a natural prison. Part of the reason you could send people in exile in Siberia, and this goes back to the times of Dostoevsky, is that there was no real way of getting back without dying, and so people were very safe out there in this open-air prison. There still are a large number of prisons there, partly because the infrastructure was all there. And this has caused a great problem. Gorbachev had an amnesty in 1987, and that doubled, tripled the crime problem in most of the major cities in Siberia, because most of these prisoners, once released from prison, can no longer get residency permits to return to their original place of living. And so they end up staying in Siberia. In fact, in Siberia, the organized crime problem is much larger than it is than you would think it would be for the size of the cities. The biggest business in Kemerovo, the sort of capital of the coal area of Siberia, the Kuzbass province, one of the biggest businesses there now is steel doors, because as soon as you buy a video or a television or anything, any of the new Western goods that some people are getting access to, you can't buy one without at the same time buying a steel door to protect it against intruders.
The prisons that are in Siberia now, are they mostly for criminals? Is there any remnants of the political prisoner population?
As far as I could tell through my trip, there were no political prisoners left at all.
You visited a maximum security prison in an industrial city in Siberia. What was it like?
It was, first of all, you have to keep in mind that when you go to a place like that, you're sort of set up with the prisoners that they think will not, you know, cause you problems. It was interesting that we went on a Sunday. They've been having problems in having outsiders come into the prison. There's hostage taking and there are more escapes. They were very careful about that with me. They wanted to make sure I wasn't taken hostage, and that was the reason they said they were always with me, although I think part of it was also they wanted to make sure I wasn't told too many horror stories about what happened in the prison. But it's interesting, the whole idea of hostage taking and escape, because before, there was very little reason to escape into Soviet society, because there was very little likelihood that these people could then disappear and not be taken again. But in a new atmosphere and freedom, there's more reason to escape, so now they're facing more problems. Second problem in the prison is because there's a mafia and a sort of organized crime ring going on outside the prison, there's recruitment that goes inside the prison, and there's a new sort of boss system like we have in our own prisons. And so they now have to deal with the fact that they're bosses within the prison, and they can't control the prisoners as well as they used to be able to control the prisoners.
One thing I found kind of odd, you said in the maximum security prison that you visited, there was music being piped in that sounded like, you know, Mantovani plays the Beatles, very, very music-y kind of stuff. Was there a psychological function of the music?
Yeah, I think partly there's this calming function.
God, it really irritates me. I don't know about you.
Oh, I think it would drive me to crime. But it's interesting because they now no longer have the party. before they would say, okay, this ideology is going to somehow keep you in line, and you should believe in this ideology and you should follow it. Now they have to start thinking, well, are we going to have prison chaplains? Are we going to, is there some other goal that we're going to have to point these people toward? It was very interesting talking to the warden, because he was very upset that the Communist Party had shut down and that he could no longer have party meetings with all his guards. And I said, well, why are you upset about this? And he says, well, it isn't so much the ideology. He says, you have to understand, we were raised this way. We had these meetings. This was our social time. We talked to each other. People would bring problems to us. When a woman's husband was cheating on her, she would then come to the party, and the party was then to set that man straight, or at least solve the problem in the couple. And he says, now I don't have any means to do that any longer.
Your trip to Siberia ended 3 weeks before the coup in the Soviet Union. Now that the Soviet Union has broken up, what's the status of Siberia? Is it an independent republic now?
No, it's still a region with various republics. It's not an independent republic itself. There is a separatist movement, people saying, let's break off Siberia. It's rich. We can do well. We don't want to carry the burden of the rest of Russia. But at the moment, that separatist movement is primarily being led by old communists who are trying to fight against Yeltsin. And I don't take it particularly seriously at this point, although the State Department is monitoring it and with some interest.
Do you think that Russia now wants to change the image of Siberia?
I think Russia would, yes, very much like to change the image of Siberia from a place of gulags to a place of riches, both of which it is. You see Western investors probably more interested in Siberia than any other place in Russia, because there you can recover the wealth more quickly than anywhere else.
Why more quickly?
Well, it's raw materials. Mm-hmm. You can get the oil out and you can sell it to the West. You don't have to worry about labor problems. You don't have to worry about setting up a plant. There's peat there in endless quantities, oil in large quantities, gold, For years, the center was telling them how they should recover the oil, and it wasn't done properly, and it wasn't changed, and they recovered it very poorly. Now they're saying the West has to teach us, so they're looking for someone new to give them guidance about how to take care of their raw materials. But on the other hand, they've been taught for so many years about how the West exploits its people with its riches, that they're very nervous about turning over their raw materials, their resources, the good Russian earth, to foreign companies.
One last question for you. You've been writing for the Wall Street Journal for the past few years. Has the attitude in other countries to the Wall Street Journal changed since the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union? Because I think the Wall Street Journal symbolizes capitalist newspaper, because it emphasizes business coverage and Wall Street coverage, and because Wall Street's in its title, of course. So has the attitude in former communist countries changed about your newspaper?
I was surprised how the words Wall Street could open up doors. We have been in propaganda for so long and been spoken about so negatively for so long, if not the newspaper itself, then Wall Street generally, that we have a certain credibility.
Well, Frederick Kemp, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the conversation.
Frederick Kemp's new book is Siberian Odyssey. Kemp is the Wall Street Journal's Berlin bureau chief. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Peter Medak is a filmmaker, but his own life reads like the script from a movie. As a boy growing up in Hungary, he fled first from the Nazis and then the communists. Now he's best known for such films as The Ruling Class, The Craze, and Let Him Have It. Coming up, Medak's movies and his life. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new CD by composer Edward Wilkerson's group, Eight Bold Souls. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Researchers at the International AIDS Conference underway in the Netherlands held a special session today. They talked about reports that some patients are getting AIDS, apparently without becoming infected with the AIDS virus. So far, researchers cannot explain why. NPR's Michael Scholer reports from Amsterdam.
Scientists finally heard some details about these mysterious cases. One researcher from Cornell University spoke of five people, all in New York, who developed classic AIDS symptoms, even though after extensive testing, no trace of HIV was found in their bodies. Other researchers in the audience said they too had seen patients like these in other parts of the world. No one is quite sure what to make of the reports, which first surfaced more than a year ago. Some suspect a new type of AIDS virus may have infected these people, a virus that current tests don't recognize. But so far, there's no evidence this AIDS-like disease has been passed from one person to another, and no evidence a new virus is causing the symptoms. Whatever is going on, it's rare. In the U.S., just a dozen or so patients seem to have the problem, compared to 250,000 AIDS cases caused by HIV. This is Michael Scholer in Amsterdam.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin has ordered his nation's defense minister to move against corruption and stop the sale of army property. A spokesman said the Russian leader had used sharp terms in speaking to a meeting of military chiefs and indicated that some might lose their jobs. Several times in the last month, Yeltsin said that Russia need not fear a military coup, but there is concern over poor living conditions and planned army cutbacks. Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Federal Reserve, told a Senate committee today that he predicts a modest economic recovery, despite few visible signs of one. However, as NPR's Eric Weiner reports, Greenspan's prediction was met with some skepticism.
In his semi-annual report to Congress, Alan Greenspan held fast to his prediction that the U.S. economy will soon, quote, gain momentum. But the senators on the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee responded that they've heard that before from Alan Greenspan, and yet unemployment continues to rise. Greenspan defended his action, saying that interest rate cuts alone can't revive the economy.
I do not believe this notion that we can, quote, jumpstart the economy. The more relevant consideration or analogy is more the question of turning an ocean liner around fairly quickly.
Greenspan reminded the committee that under his leadership, the Federal Reserve has cut interest rates 23 times in the last 3 years alone. I'm Eric Weiner in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 5 points to close at 3,308. This is NPR News. According to news reports in Moscow, a warship of the Black Sea Fleet has deserted its Navy command and gone to the port city of Odessa in Ukraine. At a meeting last month, Russian and Ukrainian leaders called on fleet personnel in the Black Sea not to declare their allegiance to either of the two countries that are trying to settle a dispute over the future of the fleet. The former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is denying allegations that the U.S. conducted a secret war against Iran in 1987 and 1988. Retired Admiral William Crowell told the House Armed Services Committee today that there was also no cover-up of the circumstances that led to a U.S. ship shooting down an Iranian passenger jet in 1988. John Greenberg reports.
Crowell's main defense was that even if the American public didn't know all the details, the U.S. Congress did. He said the classified report to Congress on the error that cost more than 200 Iranian lives laid out where the Vincennes was when it fired and how it got there. But he acknowledged that the unclassified version omitted such details. Responding to charges by Newsweek magazine and ABC's Nightline that the U.S. was fighting a covert war against Iran, Kral said there was little that was actually covert.
Countless articles appeared in the U.S. newspapers and magazines about our anti-mining efforts and night operations and revealing the existence of barges off Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, which acted as bases for helicopters and patrol boats.
Members of the committee did not challenge Kral's version of events. For National Public Radio, this is John Greenberg in Washington.
The Pentagon says that there are now serious questions about plans to build a combination helicopter airplane. After the second crash of the controversial plane in just over a year, the experimental V-22 aircraft crashed while attempting to land yesterday at the Quantico Marine Air Facility. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Peter Medak is a director who's had the kind of life they make movies about. He grew up in Hungary, fled from the Nazis, and returned to face the repression of the communists. He was able to get out of Hungary in 1956 during a popular uprising which was quickly suppressed by Soviet tanks. Medak moved to England, where he got into the film industry and made such movies as A Day in the Death of Joe Egg and The Ruling Class. In the 80s, he went to Hollywood and directed Zorro the Gay Blade and The Changeling. He returned to England for his last two films. The Craze was a complex character study based on the true story of Britain's most famous post-war gangsters. His latest film, Let Him Have It, is also based on a true story in post-war England. It's about a mentally handicapped teenager who was talked into robbing a shop by a younger friend. Unfortunately, this fine film didn't play in theaters very long, but now it's available on video. Since both Let Him Have It and The Craze are about crime, I wanted to know what impact crime films had on Medak.
Well, very little, in fact, because unfortunately, I never see enough movies. I love films very much, but I never see enough pictures. You know, in America, film directors grow up totally on every frame of every movie because it's so much on television, it's being repeated. You know what I mean? They're all experts at it. I mean, but I'm not kind of obsessed or educated on all those frames of the old movies, so it didn't have an effect of it on me. However, it had something indirectly had an effect on me, is because when I was in Hungary and when I was a small child, I couldn't go to school because of my parent, my father, who was imprisoned by the Russians and this and that, and the usual story. And I used to hang out outside the American embassy, in the British embassy, because I had nothing to do all day long. And I pretended to be an American spy, you know. And I really, much more of those things get into the film indirectly.
So let me ask you, when you were posing as an American spy,
yes.
What would you do to get the right look?
I just had this raincoat, which my aunt sent from England. And I turned the collar up, and I was just kind of hanging about, looking at the photographs of Harry Truman opening up bridges. I mean, what they did in the American embassy in Hungary at the time, because it was really totally... I don't think people have the conception what it was like to be behind the Iron Curtain. And this is... I'm talking about 1950, 1948 to about 1955. You were totally closed off from the world. And the only way you could see what the West was like is if you dared to go in front of the embassy and look through the window. And they had like shop windows and a book turning with photographs of what was going on in America, about Marilyn Monroe and Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower and all that. And you just... they used to sell corn on the cob in the street corners here, the way they sell pretzels. And I was just chewing, and I was saying, oh, well, I've got the upper hand because they don't know that I'm really working for the Americans. And I used to watch them, the American jeeps come from the airport and load and unload the empty bottles of the Coke with the full bottle of Coke going into the embassy because you couldn't buy Coca-Cola. But the image of the West for me was the Coke bottle, and I didn't really have it until I escaped out of Hungary. And it's a long story, but I mean, two of my friends, I left with three friends, And we wandered into this Austrian village, and both of my friends fell asleep in the stables. And I wandered down the village street, and there was this Coke machine at this gas station. So I rushed back and I woke both of my friends up, and I said, guess what, there's this Coke machine, we can have our first Coke. And we staggered down the street, and whatever little money we had, which we were given at the border when we got out, we put into this machine, and nothing came out. And we were just standing there, these three little kids in the wind blowing in front of the image of the West, and it was broken.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, like so many of us have experienced not getting anything when you put in your quarter or your 50 cents or whatever now, but it never has had that kind of symbolic importance that it must have had to you.
Yeah, but it and also, you know, watching it outside the embassy, always the empty bottles of Cokes coming out and the full crates going in and not be able to taste it.
Yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Medak, and his new movie is Let Him Have It. He also directed The Craze and The Ruling Class. What was your father imprisoned for?
Well, tragically, we tried to escape in 1948, and we left on the wrong weekend, and we never got out. And the people who were going to smuggle us out of the country were caught a couple of weeks later, and all the names who were going to get out were spilled. And then, because of that, he was arrested. And once he was arrested, then they created a kind of a fake trial, and they proved that he was an American spy, which he, of course, wasn't. And it's because of that I was supposedly a son of a capitalist. I wasn't fit to be educated, so I didn't go to school since I was 13.
You weren't permitted to go to school because of that?
No, which in a way I was very delighted about, but I mean, I was very envious of all my friends who went to college and universities, but I never had the chance to do that.
So you managed to escape from Hungary in, I think it was 1956?
56, yeah.
You went straight to England?
Yes, I did. I mean, first I went to Austria for a couple of weeks.
How did you start making movies? How did you start training for it?
Well, I fortunately, through my aunt, who was a very famous opera singer, who was incredibly well connected, I was introduced to an American gentleman who was, his name was C.J. Latta, and he ran Warner Brothers in England. And I went to see him, and he said, look, don't worry, you know, give me a couple of weeks and I'll find you some position. And he got me my first job as a trainee. And that's how I really started.
So here you were in this pretty awkward position. You didn't really know English very well. You hadn't grown up watching a lot of movies.
No.
Because there weren't a lot of movies in Hungary to be watched. And here you were trying to make movies. So you were pretty handicapped. It must have been hard to get started.
Well, the only thing is that I dreamt about making movies, though, since I was 8 years old. And it really came that this aunt of mine, the opera singer aunt, gave me a present for birthday of mine. It was for my 8th birthday or 10th birthday, I'm not quite sure which one, which was a 35mm hand crank projector and a piece of film. And I then started projecting this piece of film for everybody, days on end. And it really started my obsession. But I think what drove me to making movies was my loneliness in my own little life, of being isolated from my friends, of not being allowed to go to school. You know, so I really spent my time dreaming. Looking out the window and seeing things in the sky and pretending, you know, this whole thing about pretending an American spy, pretending to be something you're not and play acting and trying to play out games.
If you're just joining us, my guest is film director Peter Medak. His new movie is called Let Him Have It. He also directed The Craze and The Ruling Class. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is film director Peter Medak, and his films include the new movie, Let Him Have It, and the craze. There was a period in your career early on when you worked in American television. I guess this must have been the late 50s or early 60s, because I know you worked on such programs as Alfred Hitchcock Presents and The Virginian.
Yes.
I'm wondering what it was like for you as this Hungarian emigre who didn't grow up watching Westerns to suddenly be making one of these like TV genre series like The Virginian.
It was wonderful. I mean, what happened actually that I was an assistant director in England, and the last movie I worked on was a film called VIPs with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And while I was on that film, I was offered this wonderful chance to sign a contract with Universal Studios, which was called then Review Productions, to come out for a few weeks to observe American television the way they're doing it, and then go back to England and work for them. So I spent some time with Alfred Hitchcock, who was doing Marnie at the time. And that's when I first met Sean Connery. And then I spent time on Virginians and Wagon Train. I started to do second units and bits and pieces. And it was incredible because I was wandering under the back lot of the studio and had access to the library, and I could find in the same location silent movie day clips of what was shot in the studio. And it was just magical.
Your two recent movies, The Craze and Let 'Em Have It, are both, in a way, about people coming of age after the war in England. Now, you didn't live in England after the war. You were still living in Hungary. But can you just give me a little bit of a sense of what it was like for you right after the war? Because I would guess from these films that it had a big impact on you.
Yes, it was very, well, traumatic, but wonderful as well, because, you know, having escaped from Budapest in 1944, and then be hid next to the Gestapo in the country, in a little village where the village changed hands between the Germans and the Russians three or four times, and we had to pretend to be Catholics, and my name was changed from Peter to something else, and I could never understand it. Why did I have to go to... And we weren't religious whatsoever. But why did I have to go to church every Sunday? And then when the war ended, of going back to Budapest, there's an incredible story. The day when we escaped out of Budapest in 1944, we were sitting down for lunch, my brother, me, and my mother and my father, and the maid was serving soup. And she went back to the kitchen, and she rushed in and said to my father that all the people from the opposite building are being taken away by the Hungarian SS. And my father rushed out, and he came back and he said, "We got to leave right now." And we got up from the table with the four soup plates there, rushed down from this fourth floor, this wonderful kind of marble building, and got to the front door when a man was being chased by an SS guy and there was gunshots, and my father said, "Look, whatever you do, don't turn around." And we walked out to the street and walked past the dead body of this person who they just shot a second ago. And by some miracle, we got away before the SS surrounded our building and escaped out of Budapest. Then we hid, as I said, in the country for a year. And when the war was over, we came back to Budapest, and on a train, like all those pictures of the Russian revolutions where millions of people are on the top of the train. But my father put two wooden planks between the bumpers of two carts, and that's where we were sitting, and you could see the ground passing, and I still see it. And we finally got back to the apartment in Budapest. We went up, and the wall was completely blown in, and you could see out into the kitchen, to the building where the Jews were taken away just before we escaped. And I was standing in the dining room with all the rubble on the floor. And to my amazement, there was the dining table with the four soup plates on it, with the dry soup still in it, a year later. And here, I was a little kid, just couldn't understand it, that all these terrible things happened in the world, and the world had turned upside down. And here I was in this room where time has stood still. And I hope one day I can really make a movie about it, which would use up all these images, because there are so many of them like that. But I will never forget those dried soup plates.
Wow, yeah.
I really became familiar with your work through your last two movies. I mean, I'd seen The Ruling Class, but I saw that a long time ago. But I was so struck by your last two films, by The Craze and Let Him Have It. And I'm wondering if you think of yourself as being in a different part of your career artistically.
Yes. No, I think I am, because after Ruling Class, I've gone through a lot of personal problems. My first wife committed suicide, and it gave me a terrible shock, you know, and it takes many years to get over that, if one ever gets over it. And you lose your judgment, and you get affected by other people or what film studios want and this and that, and you lose yourself. And I felt that I lost myself, really, and really at the 11th hour, when it was nearly too late, I realized that I have to go back to my roots, which is in England, and go back to square one and do what I always been able to do, which were small, very intimate stories. And that was very important to me. And I feel that I lost myself, that I found myself completely and totally.
Well, I look forward to seeing your forthcoming films.
Good.
And I thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
Peter Medak's latest film, Let Him Have It, just came out on video. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, I hear you're talking about the economy on All Things Considered.
That's right. We'll be hearing what the Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, said today on Capitol Hill. Also, a comparisons of the Republican and Democratic economic programs in their platforms. And we'll also be hearing about a proposal that was in Ross Perot's economic plan. That's to increase the tax on gasoline by 50 cents a gallon over the next 5 years. We'll be hearing from an advocate of that idea, former Senator Paul Tsongas, and an opponent of it, a man who lobbies on energy issues for the AAA in Washington. Also, a report on the black townships of South Africa from Ann Cooper.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Chicago's Black Music Cooperative, the AACM, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, has spawned some of the most creative jazz composers of the last 25 years, like Henry Threadgill, Anthony Braxton, and Mujal Richard Abrams. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the best AACM composer under 40 is Edward Wilkerson Jr. Kevin has a review of a new album by Wilkerson's group, Eight Bold Souls.
In one way, Edward Wilkerson's octet Eight Bold Souls is right in step with other medium-sized jazz bands which emerged in the 1980s, like Henry Threadgill's septet or John Carter's octet. Flexible groups with the agility of a small combo, but which suggests the orchestral scope of a big band. But in another way, Eight Bold Souls is as far from 80s trends as you can get. The 1980s was when postmodernism came in, when composers like John Zorn made music that relied on quick and abrupt jumps from one style to another. By contrast, Wilkerson is rarely in a hurry to get from one idea to the next. Thank you. That's from Wilkerson's composition, Glass Breakers, from the Eight Bold Souls album, Sideshow, on the new Arabesque Jazz label. The band's lineup, including cello and tuba, as well as the usual saxophones, trumpet, and trombone, lets him hint at everything from a chamber ensemble to a New Orleans brass band. Sometimes it seems Wilkerson wants to circle the globe in a single piece, incorporating a little of everything. Like other AACM composers, he'll use any style to his own ends. His theme, Light on the Path, sounds like something from Miles Davis's last funky period, but with a lighter touch. At other times, Eight Bold Souls owes a debt to bandleader Sun Ra, whose sort of fake Egyptian mood pieces inform the tune Black Herman. You can hear Ra's influence in the subtle figures played behind the leader's tenor sax solo. Wilkerson's emotionally direct but controlled vocal quality links him with elder Chicago tenor players like Von Freeman and Fred Anderson. Edward Wilkerson's not the only fine soloist in this band, but the Souls don't get many opportunities to strut their stuff on their new album. One problem with the slow rate of change Wilkerson favors is that solos tend to be long and few. Only one clarinet solo from multi-instrumentalist Muwata Bowden isn't enough for me, even if it is a long one. With so much space to fill, he tends to repeat himself. Although Edward Wilkerson is involved in three recording groups, including his big band Shadow Vignettes, he's not a very prolific composer. Sideshow is only Eight Bold Souls' second album in 5 years, and so far the band has recorded only 10 of his compositions. Wilkerson's too good a writer to work that slowly. He should get out his pen and get on the stick.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Sideshow by Eight Bold Souls on the label Arabesque Jazz. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the king of horror fiction, Stephen King. He'll read from his new book and tell us what most terrifies him. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.